I'm trying to get harder and tougher mentally and physically every day of my life.
You're either the growth mindset or you're the fixed mindset.
If you're trying to be the best, you need to look at who the best is and see what they do.
Relentless pursuit of progress. There's a difference between the best
and the rest.
And the rest.
Welcome to the Michael Kaz Podcast.
Champions are built in the mind first.
Where we interview scientists, world champions, doctors, and experts in just about every area of health and fitness.
What do you care enough about? What are you fascinated enough about to go so deep and learn so much that you'll know more about it than anyone else?
And now, here's your host, Michael Kazu.
Hey, and welcome to the Michael Kaz Podcast. Today, I am joined by Mike Brown. I met Mike about a year and a half ago at a leadership program that we were both involved in. And holy shit, is this an intimidating guy. Fighter pilot, incredibly successful entrepreneur, and just a highly, highly self-aware and kind person. Today, we start out talking about him opening up for Jimmy Buffett while he was in the Navy. We talk all about his journey to becoming a fighter pilot and some of the stories that went along with that whole journey. We talk about him starting his business in the oil industry and how he went on to sell it for over eight figures. And what I was most interested in and the way that I see Mike making the biggest impact on the world is some of his thoughts around hard work and ambition. Obviously, to reach the level of success that he has, he must have had both in spades. And he has some really counterintuitive thoughts on both of those. And I really encourage you to hear him out on this stuff. We talk about how he's focused on learning to create from stillness and what that means, as well as the coaching he's doing to help business owners find clarity in their lives. This one was a blast, and I really hope you enjoy it. Please help me welcome Mike Brown.
Mike Brown, what's up, brother?
Hey, man. Thanks for having me.
Of course, dude. It's so great to reconnect with you. We've got a lot to discuss today. First, I'm so curious. You said you had a story about opening up for Jimmy Buffett while playing in a band in the Navy. Please tell me about that.
Jump right to the heart of it, man. Yeah. I like it. Then I'll have to use all my good material at the beginning. So basically, I was in the Navy for 12 years. I flew jets and I was deployed to Operation Iraqi Freedom in 2007, 2008 aboard the USS Truman. And this was around the time of the John McCain troop surge. I don't know if you remember that, but you know, there was a little bit of action going on in Iraq. And at one point, basically you're supposed to pull into port about every, you know, 30 to 60 days. And I mean, that is what you live for when you're on the aircraft carrier. Like you're flying, you're working super hard, you're, you know, combat, there's a lot of stress. And then, you know, you pull into port, and in this case, we were going to Dubai, and you just rent the best hotel room you can and just rage and blow off steam for a couple of days. And, you know, you can imagine what a group of 35 fighter guys can get in over a weekend. So, I mean, ports are like the sacred jewel of cruise. And we were getting ready to pull into Dubai, and there was some kind of security risk. And they said, hey, sorry to tell everybody, but the port's canceled. We're going to pull onto the pier. And there's this little fenced off area around the pier that has like a few restaurant shacks and stuff. And you can get off the boat and you can get a few beers there. And that's it. So you basically like walk down the ramp off the aircraft carrier, and you're in like a 2-acre space with 5,000 sailors.
Wow.
All who haven't gotten off the boat. And we were just so bummed. And so like the week leading into this port visit, like everyone is just like down in the dumps, like morale is in the garbage. And then they announce, hey, we've got a special treat for you guys. We're going to get Jimmy Buffett to come play the sandbox. That's what it was called. The stage there is the sandbox. And I mean, people were just going nuts. And then the leadership of the of the boat came to us and we're like, hey, we heard you guys have a band. We need somebody to open up for Buffett. And we were like, oh man. So let me just set the stage. I am not a musical person. I love music. The one talent that I wish I had was the ability to like hear and be a great musician. Mm-hmm. And I just suck, but I can memorize it. Like, and I have a blast playing and I'm just never going to be a great musician. And three other guys on the boat, thank God they were all really good musicians. They carried me and just like allowed me to play bass because, it turns out bass players are really hard to come by. So I basically just learned bass just enough to play with these guys. And we are a punk rock band. I grew up loving like SoCal skate punk, like Bad Religion and NoFX and Pennywise. Uh-huh. And so super obscure music. We play a bunch of punk rock. We've written a bunch of originals. And now we're going to open for Buffett.
Whoa.
So I've never played a live show in my life. The band has never played a live show in someone's living room, much less.
Oh, my God.
In front of 5,000 sailors who have been on the boat for 60 days. They're not allowed to go to Dubai. And all they want to do is drink and watch Buffett. And now you've got my band standing in the way of 5,000 angry sailors waiting for Buffett. And we're about to play punk rock.
What were y'all called?
We were called the Smug because we were super music snobs. And so we come out. And our opening song was Los Angeles is Burning by Bad Religion. It's a 3.5 minute song. And we were so nervous. We played it in about 2 minutes and 15 seconds.
Yes.
We played five songs total. We played two originals. And it was just this unbelievable experience. I'm on this high. We finish. We're all high-fiving. We get down and we're in the front row for Buffett. And he comes out. And the crowd just goes nuts. And Buffett goes, all right, everybody, give it up for the Smug. Those guys were loud.
They were loud? Wait, hold on. He said they were loud?
That's the best thing he could say about it. He gives us this dramatic pause and he goes, give it up for the Smug. Those guys were loud.
Oh, shit.
So we just got dissed by Buffett in front of 5,000 people. That's my musical claim to fame.
That is both brutal and amazing at the same time. 5,000 people. Holy shit.
Hey, Jimmy, if you're listening to this, all your songs sound the same.
Yeah. He's an avid listener of the show. So he'll get back to you at some point. So yeah, man, tell me
my music claim to fame.
That's amazing. So tell me about your journey of deciding that you wanted to be in the Navy to becoming a fighter pilot, because this is a really essential part of your story.
Yeah. So, when I was young, I always knew a couple things. I knew that I wanted to be in the Navy and I knew that I wanted to be an entrepreneur. And there's a couple of reasons for that. One is, when I was in third grade, I read Patriot Games by Tom Clancy, mm-hmm. and Jack Ryan went to Naval Academy and he taught at the Naval Academy. So I decided in third grade that I was going to be Jack Ryan and I'm going to go to the Naval Academy.
Wow.
And literally just kind of never looked back. Like that was always the path I was going to do. And I never shifted. And that was always my focus in high school. And so I, you know, worked hard and got good grades and athletics and all of that. And then I got to the Naval Academy and I tend to have a bit of a problem with authority. And it turns out this place is just not for me. I took the John McCain route through the Naval Academy, which is, I was in the top 95% of my class. So managed to get by the skin of my teeth. It wasn't academic trouble that I got into. I got in a lot of conduct trouble and ended up having to serve a bunch of restriction, had a lot of demerits. They were not super impressed with me jumping the wall to go drinking on weeknights. So got in a lot of trouble, and so I ended up toward the bottom of my class. And the way the Naval Academy works is, you get to select your service selection based on your class rank. Well, I'm at the bottom. And so there's only a couple of choices left. It's either SWO, which is surface warfare officer going and serving on a ship as a ship driver, or naval flight officer, which is essentially a backseater slot as in aircraft. And so I'd already been on a bunch of ships and knew that I didn't want to do that. And I was like, well, flying's pretty cool, so I'll do that. And I wanted to be a P3 NFO, which is a big, slow spy plane. But it sounded like the hookup because those guys never have to go on a boat. And I was like, I don't like boats. I'm going to do this. This sounds like the deal. The other thing I realized is I did not want to be last in my class again and have the Navy decide on my behalf. Mm-hmm. I wanted to be the captain of my destiny. That's kind of it's a much better deal to pick what you want to do. So I got down to flight school, and now flight school is the opposite of the Naval Academy. There's no more micromanaging. Like, it's big boy rules. You are just, you're given assignments. You show up, and like every day is a final exam. So, I mean, I studied my ass off. I worked super hard and ended up getting number one in my class. And I walked into the CO's office and he asked me what I was going to choose. And I said, I want to pick P3s. And he said, oh, no, you're not. The number one guy goes jets. And I was like, oh, but everyone said that if I got number one, I would be able to go P3s. And he said, nope, that's not how it works. Number one goes jets. Good luck. So it turns out that was the best decision the Navy ever made for me. I got to the fighter squadron and flew F-18Fs. And so I was a backseater. And it was just the most unbelievable experience. I mean, just being around that kind of high-level performance, getting to test myself in combat. I mean, it really shaped basically everything that I've done since then. Really, a lot of it was shaped in that experience.
Tell me about these planes. What did you call them?
So it's a F-18F Super Hornet. It's a strike fighter. It does both air-to-air and air-to-ground, and it's the Navy's.
What does that mean? Primary. Like you can shoot things in the air and you can shoot things on the ground?
Yes. So yeah, you carry a mixed loadout of air-to-air missiles. So if you were to get in a dogfight, you could shoot down the other guy. In Iraq, of course, we basically took care of their air force on night one, so there was not a lot of air to air threat. So, So primarily, what we were doing in combat was supporting our troops on the ground, dropping laser guided and GPS guided bombs in support of troops who were actually in conflict. That was kind of the deal. It was very restrictive rules of engagement in 2007, 2008 in Iraq. So it actually took guys being engaged in combat and being in danger to then be able to run up the chain of command and be able to actually drop a bomb. But that was kind of the time then and made a lot of sense.
One of the like strongest characteristics of you is your confidence in yourself. Where did that come from, and how did that change over time as you're like, you're the top of your class academically, you're the bottom conduct wise. How did that shift over time?
People talk a lot about imposter syndrome. And I think one of the best things about the fighter program is it beats imposter syndrome out of you. And here's what I mean by that. Like, I show up to my squadron first day, I've put in 2 years of flight school. I put in another year learning to fly the Super Hornet in a training squadron. And you finally show up to your fleet squadron, and like, I have this thought of like, I have arrived. I put in the work. I've been working for this for 3 years. Like, I'm here. I'm ready to kick some ass. And you walk in, and I'm super excited to meet all the people I'm about to spend the next 3 years with. And I walk up to the first person and introduce myself, and it's a female, and she looks at me and goes, "Shut the fuck up, new guy."
Wow. Yes.
Oh. Okay. And so I was like, wow, I don't know what her problem is. And I walk up to the next guy and same exact reaction. And they sat me down on that first day and they were like, here's the deal. You don't know anything. You haven't learned anything. You haven't earned anything. For your first 6 months, your job is to sit and keep your mouth shut and listen. And the only time you're allowed to open your mouth is asking a question. And I just remember like that felt so bad. Like I was like, man, I can't, like I have all these gifts and talents. I'm ready to add to the squadron. Like I'm bringing all this talent and these guys don't want to hear from me. And early on, it was super frustrating. And then I started to see the value in it. I started to see like every time someone comes in an organization, whether that be business, whether that be the gym, whether that be, the fighter squadron, like, people think they know things, but the value in sitting around, sitting back, keeping your mouth shut and learning, hey, maybe they do things the way they do for a reason, right? Like maybe there's some actual thought that's gone into this, and that the people that came before me were making good decisions based on data that I wasn't privy to before I came into this scenario, right? And so that ability to sit up and shut up has really served me well ever since then, right? Because then you get a really deep understanding of what you're doing. You ask questions, and then at that 6 month point, you're like, oh wow, maybe there's even more I don't know. Maybe I'll shut my own mouth for another 6 months, right? Like it's really this. And then, so what that allows is you actually really build the skills. By the time you start contributing, by the time you start speaking up, by the time you start moving up in the ranks, you actually have the skills. You've done the work, you've put in the hours, you've done the practice. Now your skills are actually commensurate with your position, right? You have actually earned it. You have actually paid your dues. And so I think that really serves me really well, as far as, you know, it taught me to be humble and not just believe in my abilities before I put in the time to do things, right? And so that gives me confidence. So then as an entrepreneur, you know, starting my company, like, it, rather than holding me back, like, you know, I learned from my mentors. I learned from the people that were in the industry, and then had the confidence to make decisions because I knew I'd paid my dues and I put in my time. That makes sense.
Yeah. It sounds like you're a great listener, and that was kind of beaten into you.
Yeah, totally. Well, and the other thing is, in the squadron is they have this attitude that, you know, criticism keeps us alive. Mm-hmm. Like when I go on a flight, I want to be the hardest critic on myself so that nobody else can be. Like, I want to come back and I want to own up to all of my mistakes. And the thing is, though, it's done with humility, right? It's done with this certain attitude of like, hey, there's no such thing as a perfect flight. Mm-hmm. We're not going to dwell on the things we did well because you're supposed to do it well. And what we're going to do is pick apart every little place where we could have gotten better. And we're actually going to take that feedback and implement it the next time, right? Yeah. We're always going to strive. Like, I don't mind making mistakes, but I don't want to make the same mistake twice. Like, mm-hmm. I want to have the reputation of the guy that's going to take feedback and learn and improve every single time I go out there, right? And it actually becomes like a game. Like, you try and find all the things that you didn't do exactly right. And again, it actually instills this sense of pride. Like, it sounds like it might be super self-defeating or like too harsh of criticism, but it actually, if you go out and just say like, hey, I have this standard for myself, the standard is perfection. I'm never going to live up to it. So I'm always going to have something to come back with. It does create this humility and allows this attitude of like, hey, I am super open to feedback because that's actually, I know that's what's going to make me better. Right. And so there's this idea that fighter pilots have super high opinions of themselves. And that's certainly true at parties, but in the squadron, if somebody is unable to take feedback, like, that guy's not going to do very well. He's not going to go very far because that's how someone would thrive in a squadron environment.
Yeah, man. I think that goes for every single aspect of life. Like, when we can adopt the model of soliciting constructive criticism from everyone in our life, like, it doesn't matter how good of a leader we are or a performer or how into personal development we are, we can never spot all of our blind spots. And when we can make it safe for the people around us to give us this feedback, and we do that by demonstrating that we're not going to get defensive, we're not going to make them feel bad for giving it to us, it's really a superpower, right? So then it's not just us trying to get ourselves better. It's like a team all working so that we can improve in whatever it is.
Yeah. And it's even actually taking it one step beyond not getting defensive. It's like, hey, I'm excited for someone to offer me feedback. And even if they're a junior person, like, hey, you know, I'm not infallible. I don't know everything. If you have a piece of feedback that you want to deliver, I'm not just going to not get defensive. I'm going to be stoked to hear what you have to say. Mm-hmm. And by the way, that doesn't mean I take everyone's feedback with the same weight, right? I mean, you still have your own discernment and you still have your own life experiences. And so not everyone's feedback is, you know, carries equal weight, and you certainly have to take things with a grain of salt, right? And make sure that they're not projecting their trauma on you, or you know, I mean, there's a plenty of filters that you need to apply to feedback, but soliciting as much feedback as you can and getting excited about it, yeah, that's how you're going to improve.
One really counterintuitive thing about this is that, and I can only speak for myself, but I think this relates to a lot of people. I grew up thinking that if someone gives me constructive feedback, that makes me look weak. It makes them look better than me. And so I would avoid it at all cost. And then when I learned to start doing this and I experienced how people treated me after I thanked them for feedback and didn't get defensive, they actually trust me more. They admire me more. They think even more highly of me. Because if I can stand, you know, if I can still stand up tall after and still believe in myself after getting that type of feedback, that demonstrates a different level of confidence.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, this goes to this idea that there is strength in vulnerability, mm-hmm. right? Because, I mean, really one of the most vulnerable places you can be is standing up in front of people, receiving feedback about, you know, either actions or traits that you possess, right? I mean, that's a super vulnerable place. And to be able to receive that does actually take a certain strength. And, you know, if you reverse the idea and put yourself in the shoes of whoever's observing you receive feedback, like they're thinking like, man, I don't know if I would be able to receive that in the same way as this guy. Like, what an incredible strength. And like, and it does, it really garners a lot of respect from people. And then in turn allows them to start receiving feedback. It, mm-hmm. it allows them to actually tap into your strength and become vulnerable themselves. Right. And so, you know, if I am open to feedback from my team, that makes it safe for my team to be open to feedback from me.
Right. What are one or two of your peak experiences or like best stories you have from flying jets?
Yeah. I mean, so, you know, I mean, ultimately I think that, most people would say that the peak experience of their entire life is going to be combat, right? I mean, there's just, you know, there's no other conditions quite like putting your life against, you know, putting your life on the line against an enemy who also is putting his life against the line, mm-hmm. right? And I mean, just I remember very distinctly the first time that I was in an actual combat situation. We were going to drop a bomb, and the JTAC, which is the controller on the ground, starts reading a 9-line, which is the brief that gives you the coordinates for where you're going to be dropping and describes the situation. I can just remember like the hair on the back of my neck standing up. And I remember this so vividly. Like I could feel the back of my brain light up.
Holy
and
shit.
And time completely slowed down. And I mean, it really, it's kind of cliche, but I felt like I was operating like Neo in the Matrix. Like mm-hmm. I was moving in real time, but the rest of the world was going super slow. And it was just on this plane of consciousness and people have called it flow, elevated consciousness. There's a lot of research out there on this, but you know, that feeling is something like I've never experienced. And I spent a lot of time, after returning home, driving race cars, jumping off cliffs on snowboards, trying to do a lot of things, trying to elicit that same type of flow state. Mm-hmm. And, those things can come close, but, luckily I kind of pulled myself back from the brink before I actually, you know, seriously hurt myself or pushed too far, because, you kind of have to realize that it's just the consequences aren't the same, right? Like, that race car is not trying to actively kill you. Right. Mm-hmm. And so creating these false circumstances where you're putting yourself in danger just to maybe like feel the same type flows actually, you know, can be detrimental. And so you kind of have to keep that in check. And I think that's, you know, a lot of people struggle coming back from combat, for a lot of different reasons. But one of the things that doesn't get talked about a lot is this ultimate flow state that you tap into.
Yeah, I want to put a pin in this thrill seeking. I think we'll come back to that in a little bit. So what did you do after your career in the Navy? What was your next step?
Yeah, so I also always wanted to be an entrepreneur. That was one of the things I mentioned. I read Atlas Shrugged when I was 16. So I knew I wanted to be in the Navy.
That's a dense-ass book for a 16-year-old. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it just completely changed my life. Like I was like, man, I want to be a contributor, you know, mm-hmm. to building the society. And like, I just knew that was my calling. And so, I got out of the Navy in 2011. And at the time I was looking at doing some contracting work for the Navy, like kind of setting up my own small business and bidding on contracts. And I had lunch with a mentor of mine growing up. I grew up in Midland, Texas, which is the oil and gas capital of the US, if not the world. I was having lunch with a family friend when I was home for Christmas, and he asked me what my plans were. And I said, I was getting out and I was going to do this contracting. And he said, no, you're actually going to come work for me. It's the best time in the history of the oil business to be in the oil business. And this guy was not a billionaire at the time, but he was making a good run at it. You know, when you have an opportunity like that, I just said yes and walked through that door. And I moved my poor wife from San Diego to Midland, Texas, and worked for this mentor of mine for a couple of years before I ended up setting up my own shop. And it was just an unbelievable experience. I learned a ton, and I ended up my best friend from the squadron. We would fly combat missions together. We would come back to the boat. We would pour a tall glass of whiskey, which is super illegal on the boat, so don't tell anybody. And we would high five each other and talk about how well we worked together and that we should start a company someday. Mm-hmm. Well, fast forward to 2011, I go to work for my mentor, and he called me up and said he was getting out, and how was it going in Midland? And I said, get here as fast as you can. So he came the next day and got a job with the same firm, and we started teaming up, working deals with that firm. And then when it was time to go out on our own, the two of us started a company. You know, we figured that we had flown combat. And one of our sayings early on was that there's no emergencies in the oil business. You know, if we don't close a deal on a Friday and the funding falls through or whatever, like, that's not the same as getting shot at. So it was always a really valuable thing to have a buddy that we had been in the shit together. You know, nothing was ever going to be worse than that.
Shit, I love that saying. What effect did that saying have on you guys?
Well, I mean, you know, look, I mean, as you know, running a business is incredibly stressful in more ways. I mean, it can be more stressful than combat or flying jets. I mean, it's, you know, you always have a million glass balls and your livelihood's on the line. And I mean, there's so many different things that can go wrong in business and can and do go wrong, right? I mean, there's no perfect business plan. And so, yeah, having that experience, look, I mean, you know, the one thing that we always work on in a fighter squadron is creating muscle memory. And what creating muscle memory does is that means you're doing things the same way every single time, right? You use a checklist for everything. So every time you get in the jet, you touch the switches in the same exact order, right? And so what that allows you to do is almost go on autopilot. You do things the same way every time. What that does is when something goes wrong, that frees up cognitive load to assess the threat and create a response to the situation, right? Because my hands know exactly where to go, what switches to touch, because they've done it a million times in the same exact order. I don't have to think about what I'm doing to actually fly the jet. I have almost 100% cognitive capacity to think about whatever the emergency situation is that has arisen, create, formulate a plan, and then see if that plan is working and elicit feedback, right? Same thing goes for the business. So we would try and create a bunch of processes, a bunch of systems. We do the things the same way every time so that when an emergency does arise, because they always do, now we have cognitive ability. We already have our operations completely standardized so that when things do come up, we have the cognitive ability to think through things. And then the other part is not being attached to an outcome. We're taught to look at the situation, assess the situation, see what's happening, take in those inputs, create a game plan, and then see if that game plan is affecting the situation the way we thought it would. If that game plan does not affect the situation in the manner that we thought it would, you can't spend a bunch of time going, well, yeah, but this should have worked. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter if it should have worked or not. It's not working, right? What inputs can I take in? What you know, what data can I use to formulate a new game plan that might work? And you just, it's a constant loop. And it's actually, basically the father of tactical aviation, this guy, John Boyd. He's got an amazing book that you can read, his autobiography, but I think it's called Boyd, actually.
Okay.
He created the OODA loop, which is observe, orient, decide, act. And Air Force guys love this. I'm a Navy guy, so I like to make fun of it, but it really is the same thing. You take input, you observe this data, and then you decide what you're going to do. And then make a decision, and then we go back to observe, mm-hmm. right? So you're constantly testing your decision and see if it's actually working, right? I mean, one of my very favorite fighter guy sayings is, "Don't fall in love with the plan," right? We create a plan, we put it into motion, And then we're constantly assessing if the plan is still working. And if it's not, you don't want to fall into the sunk cost fallacy, right? And like, how many people have you seen fail in business because they're attached to this game plan that they created that's just not working, right? You have to have that adaptability and flexibility to be able to throw it out the window and go, hey, that thing really should have worked. That was a great plan. I loved it. And now I'm not attached to it. I'm going to come up with a new one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think some branches of the military might call it a post-mortem. The analyzing how a certain launch or business venture went. And I think that is one of the most crucial parts of that OODA concept that people miss. They're always deciding and acting, but very, very few business owners, very few leaders go back and try to iterate on the plan that they developed.
Yeah, totally. Right. And that's back to that criticism, like accepting criticism piece. Like when the dust is settled, it's super important to go back and actually spend time. And we call it the debrief, right? But postmortem is the same thing. If we spend an hour and a half in the air, we might spend 4 hours in the debrief going over all the things that have happened and looking at the various scenarios and like engaging how well we came up with a plan on the fly and like how well it worked out. Right. Mm-hmm. And then dissecting it and going, hey, actually, if you'd have done this, this would have worked out better. Right. And it's not this sense of like beating you up and like you can never do anything right. It's like, hey, I got a genuine curiosity here about where I could have improved. Now, the next time that game plan is in your toolkit, right? So the next time you see that situation, you already have something. You go, aha, I know what this looks like. Last time I did this, this time I'm going to do this one, and it's probably going to have a better outcome.
Mm-hmm. So I want to skip ahead here because I really want to spend some time talking about your journey over the last 4 or 5 years. Yeah. So in 2016, you sold your company for enough money that you never have to work a day in your life again. And this is really like the holy grail that I would say most Americans are striving for. Make enough money so I never have to work again. For the years leading up to you considering selling, and especially once you got really close to it, like you started shopping around for buyers and that whole deal, what did you expect that experience to be and feel like?
Yeah, so a lot there. You know, first of all, I have to correct the record just a little bit. I didn't sell in 2016. I actually, it was last year we ended up closing.
Gotcha.
But I knew I was going to sell in 2016. And I like to toot my own horn, but not quite enough money to never work again, unless I wanted to move to a pretty cheap place, but certainly enough money to not have to work for quite a long time. Mm-hmm. Right. So it did give me this incredible freedom. And I mean, you know, I was never set out with the goal of, I want to have this many millions on an exit, or, you know, that was never really the idea. And, you know, a lot of Silicon Valley companies or VC funded companies are built from day one of like, I've got to build it to X or it's a failure. You know, we were always trying to build a cash flow business that made sense, where we provided value to our investors and, we built what we could for ourselves. And so we were building a portfolio of assets. And it's because we believed, right? We always wanted to buy call options on ourselves. And that's what we always said is like, hey, you know, I can only affect decisions that I make, and I want to be the captain of my destiny. So, you know, we were building this portfolio that we believed in. And it turns out it was the best time in the history of the oil business to be in the oil business, right? And my business partner always loved to say, like, I'd rather be lucky than good. And in reality, we were a bit of both. You know, we came into the oil and gas industry at a time when, you know, new technology like horizontal drilling was unlocking tight oil reserves that previously were inaccessible, which created, you know, prices across the Midland Basin and elsewhere to skyrocket, you know, and we came in at the beginning of that. It was an unbelievable opportunity. And with that luck, we made some really great decisions along the way about the deals that we kept, about the deals that we sold.
Mm-hmm.
You know, So there's credit due on both sides, right? Like, I can certainly recognize the privilege of what it looks like growing up in a town with oil and gas. And like, look, being a white male, it certainly would have been harder for a African-American female to do what I did in the industry, right? I mean, that privilege does exist. And what did I do with the amazing opportunity that I had, right? I trusted myself because of this confidence that we talked about, you know, that I forged in the fighter squadron, made really good decisions and made some bad ones along the way and allowed for mistakes, took feedback from the mistakes that I made, learned from my mistakes, incorporated that, and then getting to a place where, okay, I've built this thing and now what do I really want out of life, right? And this is kind of what I'm referring to in 2016. I woke up and I've done all the things I was supposed to do. I built this company that was super successful. I had more money than I ever thought I would. I had been a combat tested fighter pilot. I was a triathlete. I was doing Ironmans, just pushing myself to the extreme in all of these various places. And I had this giant hole in my soul. And I didn't feel like I had any purpose. I felt like, I did all, like I said, all the things that everyone told me I was supposed to do to be successful. And I didn't feel successful myself. And that really started this journey of, okay, if this didn't make me happy, what is it that actually will?
So what did it end up being like in reality, selling your business?
So that is the most unbelievable feeling in the world. Like, you know, seeing the money hit the bank account and to me, it represented freedom, right? Mm-hmm. And look, I was super fortunate because a lot of people, you know, they hit $1 million and they go, okay, great. Now the next thing I got to do is 10. And then the next thing is 100, you know, and at some point you realize that like no monetary number is ever going to fill up that hole that I was talking about. I was pretty lucky that I recognized early on, like, hey, I've been incredibly fortunate and I actually want to get off of this treadmill. Like mm-hmm. I don't need, you know, one of the first things that happens, once you sell a business, everyone comes to you and goes, oh man, I can't wait to see what you do next. And I was like, oh shit, what I do next? Like, you know, this was a really big deal. And I feel like I hit the wildest success ever. And now I'm expected by society to go out and build something even bigger.
Mm-hmm. And by yourself.
Like, why would I do that? Like, you know, seriously, you know, something I always talk about is like, hey, you know, at some point I'm going to have a conversation with my 25-year-old son, right? And he's 8 right now. And he's going to say, hey, dad, you know, growing up, like you had this exit and you had all this money and the opportunity to do whatever you wanted. Like, why'd you start a new company and choose to leave me every day and go, you know, go slave away 100-hour weeks? And that's something I always really thought about is like, hey, I've got an opportunity nobody has. I've got an opportunity to step back, to completely slow down, to spend as much time with my kids as I can and like be a part of their growing up and, you know, do things for myself and really take the time to figure out what it is I want to do and what it is that's going to make me happy. And launching some new startup and raising money and doing all the things that you're supposed to do. Like, look, that's great for some people, but I would really challenge everyone to think about why it is they're actually doing it, especially if it's not going to move the needle. Like mm-hmm. once you hit a certain amount of success, and like I said, man, you know, getting that first $1 million or whatever it is in the bank, like that feels great. And money can't buy happiness, but not ever having to think about like if I can pay a doctor bill or a grocery bill or, you know, buy clothes for my kids, like that feels great. There is some real safety in that. And, you know, it is worth putting in the time and putting in the effort to get to a point where there is that safety. Mm-hmm. But after a certain point, like it's not going to move the needle that much. Like, you know, you have a nice house, you have the cool car, like whatever it is you want, you know, at some point buying more stuff isn't going to make you happy. Having 12 vacation homes isn't going to make you happy. Like you can burn money flying private and going to the Super Bowl and, you know, all of these things and sure, like you might get a little bit of utility out of it, but like it's not going to change your fundamental experience like that first million did, mm-hmm. right? Like, you know, really having a healthy idea of like, okay, if I'm going to do something else, it needs to be connected to a mission. It needs to be fulfilling. And maybe, you know, my definition of success needs to change, right? And maybe it's not, maybe success doesn't look like what everyone else is telling me it does. And that really starts that questioning of why am I doing the things that I'm doing?
Mm-hmm. One of the first conversations that you and I had together was about the book that I think at the time you had just decided to stop writing. Talk about what that book was intended to be about and why you abandoned it.
Yeah. So, I, I wrote a book with my business partner on how we applied fighter pilot tactics to business. And we were all set to launch it. And yeah, I mean, it's complete, and decided to actually put a pause on that because I just realized, like, I actually don't really connect with the mission of this book right now. Like, I don't want to go around talking about, to business conferences about business. Like, I was in a very much more personal, like, it didn't feel authentic to me at that time. Right. Like, and there was certainly a little bit of ego involved of like telling our story and it all felt really good. It was super fun to write. And there is a great chance that I will dust it off and, you know, rework certain parts of it and mm-hmm. release it to the world at some point. Right. But at that point, I didn't feel like it was connecting to a mission. Right. It was like, it was kind of this, hey, this is what you're supposed to be doing. Hey, you had a successful exit. Now you're supposed to write a book and go around and speak on stages about, you know, about how smart you are. And I didn't connect with that mission. Right. Mm-hmm. And I needed to figure out what it is that who I wanted to actually serve and like what it is that I wanted to do, not just stay on this treadmill of like external success, you know, what looks optically good to other people. Right. And that really was a whole unwinding of why am I running these triathlons? Like, why am I spending 25 hours a week punishing myself on the bike and running so that I can go to do these Ironmans and, you know, hit a certain time goal. And by the way, it was never fast enough. I was super hard on myself. And there's a thread that starts to get unwound here is this constantly being hard on myself with externally validated success criteria. What I had to learn was how do I extricate myself from externally validated success criteria, and how do I feel like I'm enough without doing anything? Mm-hmm. And that's really the journey that went on.
It sounds like a really big part, and I think this is what resonated with me most, was that in the past, one of the things you valued most was hard work, and that really started to shift for you. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, look, I believe that the idea that work hard and you'll be successful is one of the greatest lies ever told. And let me explain why I say that. Because there are billions of people on this planet who work hard every single day and will never hit, you know, what we think of, especially in the US, as successful, right? I mean, you think about, you know, janitorial staff, construction crew. I mean, you know, there are people that work, you know, work their fingers to nubs mm-hmm. that are never going to be successful. Right. So, you know, you hear this thing from well-meaning coaches, well-meaning parents, and, you know, always do your best, always try your hardest. Well, in reality, we can never always do our best. We can't always try our hardest, right? Really, it's about allocation of resources. You know, if I think back to high school math class, like getting a 90 is the same as getting 100 when it comes to GPA, right? It doesn't matter. Those extra 10 points don't really matter. The amount of work I would have had to put in to get 100 in math instead of 90, which is still an A, right? It looks the exact same to colleges. It looks the exact same. Is actually a misallocation of resources. Like, I am using time that I could have been better spent doing other things to hit this perfection standard of always do your best. When in reality, I didn't need to do my best, right? And I don't use high school math at this point because I have Excel to do everything for me. So you have to like look at, hey, what inputs am I going to put into the system to create the maximum amount of output? That's where I should be allocating my resources. If I'm being told to do my best in everything that I try, like that creates a lot of false dichotomies, right? Mm-hmm. This idea of never quit. I think quitting is one of the greatest things you can ever do. If you actually aren't enjoying something, like I quit triathlons. All I was doing in triathlons was trying to beat myself up. I was using it as a way to punish myself for, you know, various deficiencies that I felt I had, and then I could always point to this hard work and go, look how hard I'm working. You know, and in reality, I needed to step back and go, hey, I'm enough without ever working hard, right? And the reality is that yeah, there is some value in doing hard things. Certainly, we should challenge ourselves, and I'm not trying to tell everybody go out and be lazy, right? However, where can you be easy on yourself and look at this idea of hard work and go, hey, maybe actually the best thing I can do for my startup right now isn't working 100-hour week. Maybe it's actually taking some rest, taking some time off, getting out in nature, clearing my mind. and focusing on the two or three things that I know that can move the ball forward, right? Like that's actually going to make me a more effective business owner than grinding myself to the bone, working 100-hour weeks, sleeping under my desk.
And that strategy may not always make more dollars. It may not make your business more materially successful, but a lot of what I hear you saying is it's not all about material success. It's about loving yourself and loving your life and taking time, taking space for yourself, being gentle with yourself. Those are the actions that prove to yourself that you really love you, right? If we're constantly grinding ourselves into the dirt and being really hard on ourselves, we can read all of the Eckhart Tolle books in the world, but at the end of the day, we're just not going to believe it because our actions aren't lining up with those sorts of thoughts.
Yeah, totally, right? If you have this narrative that hard work equals success, right? Okay, yeah, sure, sounds good on the front. But what if you're successful at something without having to work that hard? Then what? Does that mean you're a failure? Right? Like that means you can't celebrate that success. Like we see people with unbelievable talents come in and you know, either in sports or business or whatever it may be, like they don't have to work as hard as somebody else. And yet our society wants to denigrate that person. Like that's a bad thing, right? Well, that's something we should actually be celebrating is like, wow, look at the success this person can achieve without having to put in the hard work. Like that's something to marvel at and appreciate, right? And the other thing that we do is when we set this impossible standard for yourself, now you can always confirm that you're not good enough, right? Well, I could have worked harder. Well, yeah, you could always work harder, right? You could always put in more hours. You could always, right? It becomes this vehicle for you to beat yourself up. And man, self-love is not something that I would have appreciated as a concept in the military, right? Like that would have, like you said, like, oh man, that's weak. Self-love, what is that? No, I'm here to work hard and, you know, show the world and all this stuff. But, you know, going back to that giant hole in 2016, when I had done all the things I was supposed to do and that society was telling me was important, and I still didn't feel good about myself. That's because I took every opportunity to beat myself up and create new standards that I could never live up to. Right. And it was this vicious loop that kept me with a constant critic in my mind and in my internal dialogue. And that was what needed unwinding. And that really is the path to self-love. And on the backside of that, like it's unbelievable now. Like I have such a healthier relationship with so many different things, like working out, you know, working out two or three times a week, like going, getting, you know, yeah, I'm still keeping really fit, but I would venture to say that like grinding yourself with 25 hours a week of running and biking, like that's going to lead to actual long-term health problems. Like people love to say like, oh yeah, I'm the epitome of health. And like, maybe so, but man, like what are you doing to yourself long-term? Yeah. If I can go to the gym three times a week and maintain a really, you know, healthy level of fitness without using it as an excuse to punish myself, that's where I want to be.
One of the things that I think we glorify most in this country, especially in men, is ambition. And, you know, from the outside looking in at someone like you, I can see so many people, myself included, being so inspired by your level of ambition at different points in your life. Like the ambition to go and become a fighter pilot, like one of the most competitive things in the entire military, and building a business that exited for eight figures. Like those are enormous things that take so much focus and time. What are your thoughts on ambition? Like what is it worth to you now?
Yeah. See, and that's, and one of the, I love this question because, you know, there's an idea that in unwinding some of this identity that then you have to lose part of yourself. Right. And I hear that from people all the time when I start talking about kind of this personal development arc, they go, yeah, but what if I lose my edge? And my response is you probably will lose your edge, right? If your edge is coming from a place of lack, if your edge is coming from a place of never feeling enough, you're going to lose your edge, right? And look, those things really served me early on, right? And this is what happens with childhood patterns that, you know, look, when we develop, certain things happen to us, right? Some people call it trauma. I call it patterning. You know, there's a lot of different things, but we are conditioned to believe certain things that drive us. A belief that I was conditioned to have through no fault of anyone's was that love is gathered through achievement, right? If the more you achieve, the more love you're going to get. And so that drove me my entire high school, college, you know, young adult life, is this subconscious belief that the more I achieve, the more love I would have. Well, it turns out that love isn't tied to achievement, right? And that's something I had to unwind. But look at what it did get me, right? It got me to this place of incredible success, kind of, you know, living this incredible 11 out of 10 life. And so, yeah, look, ambition is really important, and it's not something that we should look negatively at. It's where it's coming from. Is it coming from a place of lack, right? Are you trying to fill up a hole of love that you're lacking in your life by creating all these conditions where you have external achievement? Or are you creating from a place of abundance, going, hey, I am enough no matter what I do? And then looking at, okay, what do I want to set my sights on if failure doesn't matter? Because my whole life, failure would have mattered a lot, right? If I'd have failed at any of those things, it would have been devastating to my psyche. Now I look at what I can do and go, hey, if I'm not afraid to fail because a failure isn't a reflection on me and I am enough no matter what, now what can I create?
Mm-hmm.
Right? I can still create big, massive things. It's just coming from a different place.
Mm-hmm. You told me a while back that you're focused on trying to create from stillness. What does this mean?
Yeah, it's a concept that, you know, it stems from that question that I was telling you. As soon as you exit, everyone's like, what are you going to build next? And I actually spent like a year really wrestling with what am I going to do next? And every time I would have an idea, it wasn't big enough or it didn't have enough impact. And I actually started falling in back to these old patterns of like, I need to build something even bigger or my self-worth is diminished, right? And there's all kinds of insidious ways that these things work our way in. Like, oh, well, you know, if you're not using your gifts to, you know, bring something massive to the world, like you're squandering it, or, you know, you're lazy, or there's all kinds of ways that people can kind of subtly drive you to do things that they want you to do that you may not actually want to do yourself. Right. And so, you know, part of this journey was actually just taking a step back and say, hey, I'm not going to do anything. I'm going to sit back and I'm going to see what arises. I'm going to see what I actually connect with and what I actually get excited about for me. Right. And so that's really what I've been doing, is just sitting back, sitting in stillness and seeing what starts to pop up and like what starts to happen. And so it's been a really cool journey of saying, man, like, I don't ever have to get back on this train of hard work and creation and building something bigger and better. Like, I'm going to allow what arises to arise. I'm going to put my focus on the things that I love and that bring me joy, and then just kind of be a passenger on the train and see where it goes. And it's really been a lot of fun to create that way.
What that makes me think of is when I'm, you know, kind of caught up in the hustle and bustle of life, it can be sometimes really hard to know what I deeply want, what I desire. And when I take space for myself, and I have lots of different ways that I do that, when I really slow down and do things that allow my mind to quiet down, I'm so much more in touch with myself and what I truly desire. What are some of the things that you do, like practices or behaviors that you do that allow you to tap into this stillness?
Yeah. So, you know, one thing is, figuring out what it is we actually want can kind of be a trap at some point, because what we want changes, right? It can change by the minute, it can change by the month, it can change by the year. And I actually kind of have an aversion to this idea that we have one singular purpose, right? Like, anytime I meet someone's like, I'm living out my life's purpose, I'm like, wow, like, that seems really limiting. Like I get that you like this thing that you're doing now and it could be really fulfilling for you, but to box it in and say, this is my life's purpose, creates almost a prison. Like, you can't do anything else. So one thing is I really try and give myself the freedom to skip from one activity to the next, or mm-hmm. Hey, I'm going to chase what feels good right now. And not in a hedonistic manner, but like, hey, if I'm interested in this, I'm going to keep putting effort into it. If it stops becoming fulfilling or interesting, I'm actually going to back away. Right. And so like riding my bike is a great example. I used to ride 5 to 10,000 miles a year, between 7 and 15 hours a week on the bike, massive rides every weekend. And I realized like, I love riding my bike. And I made it a job for myself.
Right.
So stepping back and going, hey, I'm only going to ride when I truly feel called to go ride. Right now, that looks like once or twice a week for me. Mm-hmm. And at the beginning, there was always this nagging feeling of like, man, you should be getting out there. You're losing fitness. Like, you know, all of these, you know, conditions that I had placed on myself. And it took quite a while to go, oh man, like I love this cadence of riding once a week. Feels great. Like I still get all the enjoyment out of mountain biking that I always have. And I don't have this pressure to create. So, you know, just giving yourself the freedom to do things on a cadence that feels good to you authentically is huge. The other, I mean, just massive thing is meditation. And you can't listen to a podcast anywhere now and not hear someone talk right. about meditation. Right. But there are varying levels of meditation. I got super into it.
You're at like a black belt level now, I think.
Yeah, it makes sure everyone knows I'm the best. Yes. I started with Headspace because I heard it on Tim Ferriss and I never really connected with it that much. Like, yeah, okay, I've got this 15 minutes of mindfulness and it's fine. When I started getting into Sam Harris and the Waking Up app and started learning
yes.
more about the theory of why we meditate and what's behind it, and then you know, really, what I love about the Waking Up app is that Sam introduces really advanced techniques in his first 28-day course. Like he's introducing techniques that are reserved only for like advanced Buddhist meditators that, you know, you have to sit for years and then they'll finally introduce some of these techniques. Mm-hmm. He's introducing it really early on. And I really connected with that. I really started to find a lot of benefit in this idea of headlessness and stillness. And so, yeah, I mean, meditation was massive.
But let me just say real quick, I want to ditto that. I feel like I progressed more in the first 50 days of doing the Waking Up course than I had in the previous 10 years. It is phenomenal. You can do 10 to 20 minutes at a time. Yeah, highly recommend it.
Oh yeah. And I mean, neither of us are affiliates for the program as far as I know, but I mean, it's, right. Hands down, my number one recommended thing that people get into is, you know, yeah, Calm is a $4 billion app and there's certainly some value there. But I think, you know, I hear all the time from high performers like, oh, I can't sit still long enough to meditate, right? Or I don't know how to do it right. Or, you know, there's all these excuses. And I just don't think like the Calm and Headspace style apps do a really good job of deepening that practice so you understand actually what you're doing.
Right.
And then allowing you to be easy on yourself. Right. That's one of the big things about that I like about the Sam Harris one is, hey, if your thoughts drift, you don't go, oh shit, my thoughts drifted. I got to start over. It's like, of course they drifted. Like that's exactly what thoughts do. Mm-hmm. Let's pull the attention back. Right. And so it just frames it in a way that I think it's a lot more useful for people.
Love it, man. So just to wrap up, I want to talk a little bit about your coaching that you're doing. So you don't have to work much more, let's say, in your life, right? And you're at the same time, you're already deciding to coach people to help them find clarity in their lives. Why are you doing this? And can you just give us some more details on the type of work you're doing with people?
Yeah. This is kind of what arose out of the stillness. You know, I found myself being asked over and over by my entrepreneurial friends to take a look at certain things. And I kind of developed this reputation, amongst my peer group as kind of being like a fixer. Like if people were having really tough business problems or they were feeling stuck, I would come in, I would be able to analyze. And I do think I have a really great gift for being able to kind of connect the dots at a very high level and forge a way ahead. Right. Mm-hmm. And so I did this for a few people and then more people started asking me and I had this just aversion to the word coach because, you know, there's so many like double line break Facebook posts of
right.
somebody shares a vulnerable story and then talks about how to, close high ticket sales. And I was like, oh man, like I can't imagine anything worse than trying to close high ticket sales. Like that sounds like just the worst thing I can imagine. But I mean, I found every time I would do this process with people, like I felt really fulfilled and I could see that I was really making an impact for them and helping solve problems really quickly. And, you know, basically it took me getting my own coaching and someone that I really respect coming and saying, hey, like, do you know that people actually don't take free advice? Like if you charge people, they actually put so much more commitment into the advice that you're giving them, and you're actually doing them a disservice by giving all this away for free, because you know, you have this incredible gift and a fairly unique perspective. You know, there's not a lot of people out there that kind of have served in this high performance military aspect and kind of have, so I have this, you know, mindset perspective that I think is pretty unique. And then also having the success of running an 8-figure company and having that exit, you know, that a lot of people are looking to get to. So I bring this business chop, you know, the type experience to the table, but also I've gone down this personal development rabbit hole over the last few years. And so kind of combining those two into finding roadblocks for people and unlocking those and, you know, breaking through limiting beliefs, it's just unbelievably fulfilling. And yeah, like you said, you know, I'm not doing this, as my primary income driver. It's, you know, I've got all my investments and other things set up and I love doing that stuff. So this is really just a way for me to kind of fill up my own cup in giving back and helping others. And it's unbelievably fulfilling. I love my clients. I love the work that I'm doing and, it's super fun.
That's awesome, man. And I just want to say I think it is inevitable that you're going to have a huge impact on the people you work with. You're such an attractive person to follow because you are like the epitome of the type of success that most people are looking for in life, especially men. I mean, to reach the level of success in the military and business is so, so rare. But the reason that I think you're going to be able to get through to people, they're going to come in the door through some of that. And then they will see this level of self-awareness and the ability to cut through people's bullshit that I think is almost no one has that combination. So I'm so freaking pumped for you, man. I'm so pumped that you're taking this leap and really serving people in this way.
Well, man, that's really high praise coming from you. I have all the respect in the world for what you're doing as well. And so it feels great. And that's really, you know, what kind of led me to do this is I started getting enough external feedback. There's that word again, but I started getting enough data of people saying like, hey, why aren't you offering this to the world? Like you're good at this, that I couldn't ignore it anymore. And so despite my personal feelings about being called a coach or I like strategist, I feel like that's a really good word. Mm-hmm. So just go with that.
But, cool. Yeah,
it's a lot. It really is. I'm absolutely loving the work I'm doing.
Awesome, dude. Mike, this was phenomenal. Please tell people where they can reach out if they're interested in, you know, learning more about this coaching and also talk a little bit about the podcast that you're about to launch.
Yeah. Well, I'm not a huge social media guy, but you can find me on Facebook. It's Mike Brown Actual. And, I post rarely, but if I do, it's
you know, profound.
That's it. Damn right. It is. I only post profound shit. So follow me on Facebook if you want the most profound. And then as far as coaching, I don't have a website. I'm not really advertising myself other than, you know, blasting it out on this podcast now, which is terrifying. But you can drop me an email at mike@ripplestudios.io and I will respond. And then I'm actually launching a podcast called Teach Me Everything You Know. It's been in the works for a long time. But you know, it's kind of the idea is taking world-class experts and rather than asking them about their morning routine or, you know, life hacks, trying to distill exactly what it is that makes them an expert in their field and have them give away all of their best techniques. Mm-hmm. Because I believe that the world's highest performers should be able to give away all of their secrets and no one's actually going to be able to replicate what they can do to the level that they are. Right. And so that's the mark of a true expert is someone who goes, here's exactly what I did. good luck.
Hell yeah. I can't wait to listen, man. Mike, thanks again for your time, brother. This was great.
Yeah, Michael, always always awesome to chat. And man, I love the new direction of the show. It's pretty incredible.
Thank you, dude. Later.
All right. See you, homie.